So stocks saw their biggest gain in almost 3 years.
But has yesterday's central bank action made lenders more willing to lend?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Mitchell Hartman in for Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, December 1st.
Coming up, we'll get the latest on whether Europe's credit crunch is starting to ease.
And on this World AIDS Day, a push for more generic drugs to fight the disease.
And remember Hanson, the Mbop guys? Well, wait till you hear what they're up to now.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by the Epson Workforce Pro, engineered for productivity to deliver high-speed automatic two-sided color printing, copying, scanning, and faxing. The Epson Workforce Pro. Learn more at Epson.com.
Well, the huge global stock rally that sent the Dow on its biggest one-day jump in almost 3 years seems to have ended this morning in Europe. And of course, Europe was the reason that central banks around the world decided yesterday to launch coordinated action to make borrowing easier.
They were trying to stop the European debt crisis from turning into a full-blown global credit crisis. For more, let's bring in Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, we've had 24 hours to digest this central bank news at this point, and I still want to know why they decided to do this now. Was there a big bank about to fail in Europe or something like that?
Well, there's several banks that are close to insolvency in Europe, particularly in France. That said, we saw movement by the European Union and the Eurozone officials to try to get this pact together. They've now got 9 days to go. That's a much more coordinated pact and move towards unity that opened the door for the central banks to come in and help shore up liquidity in the region, make it easier for the banks to continue to get money to fund loans in the region, and that was a big deal. It was also important that, frankly, we opened swap lines. What that means was our Federal Reserve, our central bank, and central banks around the world said they were willing to take the euro in exchange for their own currency to deal with the crisis. And that means a sort of a confidence, a backdoor confidence in the fact that the euro will survive.
And this allows European leaders some breathing room to make the decisions that they need to make to sort of get the debt crisis under control. What is next for them? What do the leaders of these European nations need to do at this point?
Well, the next step, of course, is the next short-term step, and that is in 9 days coming up with a more some reforms that show more teeth to it, more austerity, and more structural reforms in Europe so that Europe can move in unison together. If they can do that, they can provide some funding for some of the states, the sovereign states that need it so badly in a more coordinated way. And the European Central Bank can get in it if they come up with a plan that's much more coordinated that opens up some legality issues for the European Central Bank. That said, this is still years in the making for the Eurozone to really save itself. You've got to get 17 individual countries over the next several years to rewrite their constitution and agree to it. It's kind of like corralling cats.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much for that.
Thank you.
Well, for more on the ongoing efforts to get the euro back on an even keel, let's turn to our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning.
So what does this bailout say to you? That governments are on top of the crisis, or are they playing catch-up?
Yeah, they're playing catch up, and they have been since 2008, right? So Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, said that the ECB has tried almost everything possible, and he admitted that it's had almost no impact. And, you know, it felt a lot like this in the U.S. in 2008.
Right. And people continue to make parallels between this debt crisis and the mortgage meltdown of 2008.
And that's a pretty good parallel. The last time that European banks found it this hard to get money was way back in January 2008. Now, that was really almost at the beginning of the subprime crisis in the economy. And if you think about what happened back then, a lot of what the Fed did and what the Treasury did was bend rules. They had to create new rules on the fly. And the European Central Bank is doing that exact same thing now to come up with new bailouts. So I talked to Lorcan Roche-Kelly. He's the chief European strategist at Macrolytics.
There's all these strange things that are happening there that 2 years ago I would have said, no, that can't happen. No, that's legal. No, that's against the treaty. But the ECB still does it. And the reason they do it is because they will do everything they can when they come to the edge of the cliff to save the currency.
Now, that sounds like the Fed and the Treasury back in 2008. Remember TARP?
I do remember TARP. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, as we said, at the core of the central bank's action yesterday was one thing, debt. Credit markets were starting to freeze up because lenders were worried they wouldn't get their money back. From countries, from banks, from businesses, and from consumers, all of whom are carrying a lot of debt. Here to put it all in perspective for us is Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, often when economists talk about debt, they talk about it in relation to a country's economic output or GDP. Explain why they do that and how different countries are measuring up right now.
Well, it gives you a measure about, you know, how much wealth you have, how much economic activity you have relative to your debt, and how much can you carry. And there's a big debate about, you know, what is the upper limit. But when you look at the U.S. relative to the other developed nations, we're nowhere near our upper limit, and we're relatively healthy compared to most other developed nations, say in Europe and Japan.
Well, of course, you're talking about government debt, Chris. What about households within the United States and their debt, and what about companies in the U.S. and their debt?
Yeah, I find it fascinating just to break down the numbers. So if you're looking at the household debt, it's 88% of gross domestic product. Corporate, 73% of gross domestic product. And we talk about the government all the time, but it's 65%.
So it's actually lower than the others.
It's lower than the others. Now, the trend, and the trend is important, Jeremy, as you know, household debt is down. Same thing with corporates, down around 9%. And what's been happening is that the federal debt has been growing sharply.
Now, when the federal debt grows sharply and the others go down, are those happening because of each other? When a household reduces its debt, does that debt get shifted to the federal government sometimes?
You know, that's partially what's happening. I mean, look, the households are saving more. Corporations are saving more. What's the offsetting pressure? The offsetting pressure is government spending. So what you want to see is federal debt increasing. State and local government debt, by the way, is flat, while the other ones are declining. Otherwise, this economy goes into a downward spiral.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Now to news out of China today and its economy, which is slowing down, and Europe's partly to blame. China's factories slowed in November for the first time in 3 years. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
The European debt crisis is definitely having an impact on China. The EU is China's biggest export market, after all. But
it's not entirely that.
Patrick Shavonik teaches business at Tsinghua University.
It's also the fact that there's a slowdown in China.
It's an intentional slowdown. China's been tightening up lending all year to deal with an overheated property market and to battle record inflation. The good news? The strategy's working. The bad news? The resulting economic slowdown is making China's central bank nervous. Yesterday, it freed up $61 billion for banks to lend. Shavonik says, bad idea.
The role of the central banker is to take the punch bowl away just as the party's getting started. And the danger here is they just handed the punch bowl right back.
Shavonik says all this new money in China's economy will continue to inflate the property bubble and will most likely lead to higher inflation. And that means less money for Chinese consumers. Not a good sign for U.S. companies doing business in China. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Here in this country, an update to a story we brought you yesterday. The National Labor Relations Board did vote in favor of speeding up the process of unionizing businesses. A final vote is expected before the end of the year.
And here in Los Angeles, Mitchell, I don't have to tell you that the winds are just whipping around like crazy outside. 80-mile-per-hour gusts. This is the strongest Santa Ana winds in years. And last night, it closed down LAX, the big Los Angeles International Airport. For a while, had a ground stop and the power was knocked out. I have to say, kind of feels like a scene from The Wizard of Oz out there. We have the latest numbers on unemployment. More people filed initial claims for jobless benefits last week. The number's up 6,000, according to the Labor Department, probably too high to get the nation's unemployment rate down from its current 9%. That key report comes out tomorrow.
Meanwhile, nearly half of job seekers have been looking for more than 6 months, and so far Congress hasn't voted to extend unemployment benefits beyond the new year. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein went to an unemployment office in Concord.
You can see why extending benefits is such a tough question by talking with Joe.
Joe Giaquinta, Giaquinta.
Joe's been out of work for a while now.
I started collecting at the end of August of 2010.
With unemployment stuck at 9%, it's almost gospel. The longer you're out of work, the harder it'll be to shove your way back in, which is why the guy who used to fix people's furnaces has expanded his search into the kitchen.
But you know what? They're looking at my resume, what I did for the past 23 years. They say, this guy doesn't know how to cook.
At this point, Joe is just about out of benefits. University of Chicago economist Robert Shimer says giving people up to 99 weeks of benefits buys millions of Americans a mirage, the dream that they can recapture their old lives.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of workers who are not going to get jobs that look like what they were getting before. They're workers who are going to take substantial and long-term wage cuts.
Shimer says workers like Joe need to adapt and get a new set of expectations. Not easy for a 55-year-old guy who used to make around $50,000 a year.
You know, the kids are out of the house, but I still have a mortgage and I have utilities and taxes and insurances. That's why I don't want to get stuck right now in that $9 an hour job.
Some economists say not only do those benefits keep Joe and his wife in their home, that money helps drive the country's recovery. Critics argue the cash Joe gets every week would be better off in the hands of employers. Instead of paying into the unemployment system, companies would have more money to grow and hire more workers. Of course, ending those extensions means millions of people like Joe Giaquinta have to scramble.
It's forget the career, it's survival right now. I'm going to have to resort to the McDonald's or the Lowe's or the Home Depot.
If Joe doesn't get one of those jobs, he may just drop out of the labor market entirely. And Professor Shimer says there's a cost to that, too. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
In Illinois, state lawmakers have rejected a bill that would have offered millions of dollars in tax breaks to keep the Chicago Mercantile Exchange from leaving the state. So what happens now? Here's Susie Ahn from WBEZ in Chicago.
The CME Group has been at the center of Chicago's financial sector for more than 160 years. Gaston Cerrone is an equity analyst with Morningstar.
Chicago has taken on a much more visible role because of the tremendous growth that we've seen in derivatives trading, for which Chicago has been a hub.
Now, CME is threatening to leave Chicago because of a recent hike in the Illinois corporate tax rate. But a move wouldn't be cheap. Stacy Kruger-Berndorf is with commercial real estate firm Transwestern. CME employs as many as 2,000, but many other jobs in Chicago rely on it.
There are these other companies that are affiliated with them. And what about them?
And then there's what to do about the big Chicago Board of Trade building that it owns.
I'm seeing it right outside my window right now, and I can see the goddess of Ceres there, and she's not going to be moved.
The CME Group wouldn't comment on what it'll do next. In Chicago, I'm Susie Ahn for Marketplace.
And if they moved out of Chicago, could they still be called the Chicago Merc? Speaking of naming, Kelowna, Iowa is getting into that business. To raise money for city improvements, it's auctioning off naming rights to a local creek. Right now, it's called the West Drainage Ditch. Could be, I don't know, Office Depot West Drainage Ditch. Maybe the Marketplace Morning Report West Drainage Ditch. Anyway, bids will be taken on eBay.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Epson Workforce Pro, the world's fastest two-sided inkjet printer. Engineered for productivity, it delivers high-speed automatic two-sided color printing, copying, scanning, and faxing to keep your business running at full speed. With extra high-capacity ink cartridges, the Workforce Pro helps you save on ink. It prints from mobile devices like smartphones and tablets fast and easy. Check it out at Epson.com.
Well, today is World AIDS Day, and President Obama is marking the occasion by announcing a $50 million boost in funding for AIDS treatment in the U.S. Meanwhile, activists are using the day to push for generic AIDS drugs that are cheaper. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Secretary of State Clinton recently hailed the falling cost of treating AIDS per patient in Africa and Vietnam.
In 2004, the cost averaged nearly $1,100 a year. Today, it is $335 and falling.
She credited bulk purchasing, cheaper shipping methods, and what she called simply lower-cost drugs. What she didn't mention is what's driving those costs down.
That success has been possible because over 90% of the medicines we currently use are generic.
Brooke Baker is a Northeastern University law professor and an advocate for loosening global monopolies on AIDS drugs. He says the pharmaceutical lobby is trying to keep a tight grip on newer treatments by stiffening global patent protections. But he says they shouldn't be considered one company's intellectual property.
Medicines are treated like bicycles. They're simply marketplace commodities. But the difference between bicycles and medicines are people's lives and well-being depend on them.
A statement from Abbott Labs touts the company's commitment to tiered pricing for countries in greatest need. It contends that balances the needs of patients with its investment in developing new drugs. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Today, European governments will announce how they plan to cut billions in aid to Europe's Airbus. That's supposed to level the playing field with Boeing.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London with more on that story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Mitchell.
So remind us, what is this dispute all about?
About so-called launch aid, European governments lend Airbus billions of euros when it's developing a new plane like the A380. Boeing successfully argued before the World Trade watchdog that this is an illegal subsidy. Today, the Europeans will announce how they plan to get rid of it.
And will the decision today resolve the fight?
Probably not. If Boeing isn't satisfied, it'll appeal. That could take another 2 years. And in the meantime, Airbus won its trade case that Boeing is getting an illegal subsidy in the shape of tax breaks and defence contracts. And that case could rumble on for some time yet as well.
So how can we figure out, is either side really right in this dispute?
Well, they're both wrong. We're all sinners, Mitchell. But the US argues that Airbus does better out of its government subsidies than Boeing. And Howard Wealdon, an airline analyst with BCG Partners, agrees.
The Europeans have had benefited far more than the Americans have. And that's where the dispute really lies. If it was a fair and equitable system, then fine. But it isn't and it can't be.
But when is this all going to end? Who knows? It'll probably go on forever.
It's a long time. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks very much.
Okay, Mitchell.
So, Mitchell, have you heard any good jokes lately?
Well, Jeremy, actually, I have. I know a great one. Did you hear the joke about the broken pencil?
I did not.
It's pointless.
Oh, wow. We've got the audience seems to like that
a
lot.
It's a great joke. It's an excellent joke.
Now, I think that's why we don't use laugh tracks on the radio these days, Mitchell. But it seems as though the laugh track might be on its way back, judging by the current primetime TV lineup. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, why is the laugh track back? And here to talk about that with us is Joe Adalian of New York Magazine. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is the laugh track really making a comeback?
Well, it is and it isn't. There are two things to remember. First of all, there's the laugh track, which is fake laughs, and then there are real laughs that are inserted in. But in terms of what we think of as laugh track shows, basically, shows shot in front of a studio audience, yes and no. They never went away on CBS. CBS, which is always a very old school network, has kept alive the tradition of audience comedies with shows like Two and a Half Men and The Big Bang Theory. But lately we've been seeing networks like ABC and CBS and even Fox, which have moved away from those types of shows, get back into them. We have Tim Allen back on Last Man Standing on ABC, and that's been doing respectable ratings. We have Whitney on NBC, which for the last few months has soiled their Thursday night lineup with laughter, and very fake-sounding laughter, by the way.
Isn't the resurgence in comedy sitcoms mostly driven by Modern Family, which doesn't have a laugh track?
Exactly. You know, sitcoms were seen as quote-unquote dead about 4 years ago. The form had been struggling, even though, again, like I said, CBS and NBC had managed to keep some solid shows on the air. So the sitcom never really died, but it certainly was depressed thanks to a combination of crime procedurals like CSI and Law and Order, as well as reality shows. Lately, though, people have started laughing again. And that's because I think the shows have gotten better, in part because many shows like Modern Family moved away from the sort of traditional style laughs. And Steve Levitan, who is one of the co-creators of Modern Family, told me that, in fact, getting away from the traditional style has helped him with his comedy, because with four-camera sitcoms like the ones we're talking about today, you know, there's a sort of a setup and a punchline and a rhythm that develops. In a show like Modern Family, the laughs can breathe. You know, everything is, the actors are not playing as much for the camera. They're able to sort of allow jokes to sort of marinate and the audience to sort of more naturally come to laughter.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word traditional, because I'm a big fan of the show Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO, which, of course, doesn't have a laugh track, unlike Seinfeld, which Larry David also created. And when I watch that, I think, you know, a laugh track would sound so old-fashioned. It doesn't. I feel like the modern sitcom is going to not have a laugh track.
You know, that's a really good question. There are people inside networks who will debate you till they're dead as to what the actual truth is. People at CBS are firmly convinced that laugh tracks make things just funnier. And you know what? They've got a lot of evidence on their side, at least to support it from a rating standpoint. You know, Two and a Half Men is until recently the number one comedy on TV and still sort of trades places with Modern Family. You know, you sort of have the audience sort of voting both ways. I think going forward, really good comedies will probably be done without a laugh track. And that's because TV these days is a lot like film. You know, that's one of the reasons why TV has done so well the last 10 years, is because producers and networks have found a way to make their shows more film-like, to feel more special and event quality, whether it's HBO or even something like The Good Wife on CBS. And that applies now to comedy, too. You know, when you go to a great comedy movie at the theater, you don't see a laugh track. You don't have a laugh track. Why should TV bother with it either?
Well, I got to say, in defense of the laugh track, you know, you watch TV at home, often alone, and it's hard to laugh in silence in a room, you know, whereas you hear the laugh track, you sort of feel like you can laugh a little bit.
There are psychological studies, and this goes back to the invention of the first laugh track back in the 50s, that sort of show that people feel more comfortable when they have laughter. But I have to be a comedy nerd here and just a purist here and just make sure that people understand there technically is a difference between a laugh track and what's called sort of live in front of a studio audience recording. Most of the shows you see on TV today, such as Whitney or Two and a Half Men, technically speaking, do not use a laugh track.
They've got actual people laughing at the stuff.
Right. There's debate as to whether these laughs are sweetened a little bit electronically, whether there are audio tricks that can be done to make them sound more natural. Now, oddly enough, a show like How I Met Your Mother on CBS, which has very natural-sounding laughs, very mellow laughs, so you wouldn't think that they were artificial at all. All those laughs actually are digitally inserted, and they're taken from years ago. And nobody actually sits behind cameras and watches How I Met Your Mother every week. So there is, producers get very upset if you use the term laugh track because it implies artificiality. Gilligan's Island had a laugh track. MASH, weirdly enough, had a laugh track. Those shows were not filmed in front of audiences, and they had these sort of mechanical sounding laughs.
Well, Joe Adalian of New York Magazine, thank you so much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Maniacal laugh, maniacal laugh, maniacal laugh.
Thanks, Joe.
Take care.
And finally, remember the band Hanson? Here, let me refresh your memory. Well, according to Rolling Stone magazine, the guys that brought us Mbop are getting into the beer business. They are launching an IPA sometime next year. It's going to be called, get this, Mhop.
Sounds delicious.
I'm sure you'll be first in line, Mitchell, in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Mitchell Hartman. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.